Network Automation Nerds Podcast.
Hello, welcome to Network Automation Nerds Podcast, a podcast about network automation, network engineering, Python, and many other technology topics. I'm your host, Eric Cho. Today on the show, I am just super excited to welcome a true industry luminary with us, a person really needs no introduction because after decades of just trailblazing work, his name has been synonymous with the evolving of the network industry. All I have to say is if you work in this industry, chances are you probably have come across his work, whether you know it or not. And of course, I'm talking about Russ White. Hey, Russ, welcome to the show.
Hey, Eric. Way too much of an introduction. I'm just an ordinary guy. Ordinary
stuff. You and I both know that's not true. And that introduction compared to your O'Reilly Learning course introduction, that's like a fraction of it. Come on now.
Yeah. And I'm forever telling them to cut back on the O'Reilly ones when I do it. I'm like, that's too long. Just stop.
No, but it was really, it was doing you justice, right? Because, how long have you been, would you say, in the industry? Because, I think it overlaps with your service time a little bit. But, how long would you say you've been working in, networking?
Yeah, so I actually started in electronics when I was really young. So real electronics, like radio and radar and antennas. And I was climbing 90-foot towers when I was 12, 13 years old. And I had an amateur radio license when I was 12. And so I was doing all that kind of stuff and working on cube-type stuff and this, that, and the other. And then I didn't get into networking until the late 80s, I would say, mid-80s, 87, 86, something like that. Okay. So, I don't know, very close to the beginning of the internet era. But, back then, I don't know, the internet wasn't so much of a thing. We were much more around Banyan Vines and Novell NetWare. And, we had, everything wasn't Ethernet. We had Token Bus and Token Ring. And Token Bus is the one nobody's ever heard of. And Tommy Conrad, ArkNet. ArkNet was very, very popular when I first came in because it would run over twisted pair. And so you could stick it on top of old telephone lines and it was very easy to deploy. So we did tons and tons of ArkNet when I was first getting in the industry. So that's kind of, that's about the year range, 85. Now, I was doing computers a bit before that, 84, well, maybe 84, 85. I learned the code C in 85 or 86. So that was my first. I was doing BASIC and assembler on a Cocoa 2 in 83, 84. And then I think I first started working on the C language, or learning the C language in 85, maybe 86.
But so, how did that happen, though? You were saying you were climbing towers at 12. Did the insurance company have anything to say with
that? No. I grew up in a house with a 90-foot tower in the backyard and a 4-meter inverted V and a 10-meter long wire and a couple of Yagis and a box and a few other antennas up there. I come from an electronic engineering family. Everybody in my family is an amateur radio operator. And so we just grew up with it. It was just like a part of the air we breathed. We had a workbench downstairs. I had a 40-meter rig connected to the 40-meter inverted V and then the 10-meter rig connected to a 10-meter long wire. And then when I was growing up, we did what were called field days for amateur radio, which was like we would go out and we would just take field. We would take a baseball field from the city or whatever, and we would set up. And the whole goal was to be off grid for an entire weekend, get an entire operational radio station set up from the ground up with all portable equipment, and then communicate with as many other states and countries as you could in a 24-hour period. And so all the radio clubs in the world did it the same weekend. Of course, at different times based on their time zones and stuff like that. And so, we had the club. We had two or three big generators on trailers, commercial grade generators in our backyard. Mm-hmm. And we would haul them out and we had a camper and we'd go park in the middle of a field and run the generators up. And we had friends who had 60 and 70-foot towers that were temp put up. And we would run those up and we would put up guy wires and, run inverted Vs and Yagis and all sorts of other types of antennas off of them. And that's basically the way I grew up, was doing that and camping and farming, I should say. That was like the three things I was really involved with when I was a really young kid. And then, of course, I got into art and music, took piano lessons and stuff later. But yeah, really my life when I grew up was between a farm my grandfather's farm and, you know, amateur radio and boating and camping and stuff like that. It was really outdoors.
I could just imagine like a young Russ like holding a Yagi,
yeah,
hanging up a tower and be like, hey, go to like 40 degree a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, exactly. And that's the way it was, right? It was like, okay, climb the tower. Can you give me 5 degrees south?
Yeah.
You know, because you don't have, we didn't have, some of the antennas had electric motors on them, but there's only so many electric turners you can put on it. Mm-hmm. On a tower, and like a 40 meter inverted V, you can't put anything on it. I mean, it's a matter of going out and pulling the stakes and moving the stakes. And then sometimes the baling at the top gets messed up and you got to go up there and figure out what's going on with the baling and, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. So that's how I kind of grew up, was in that world. And then, you know, when I got into high schoolish a little bit later on, even while I was working on doing an art degree and a music degree during that time period, I got a Coco 2.
Okay.
And started, I mean, I'm like, for me, it's not like fun to use stuff. It's more fun to build it. And so my first thing was always, okay, let's go figure out how this thing works. And I went and learned.
I'm sorry, what is a Coco 2? I'm not very familiar with it.
Yeah, it's a Radio Shack.
Okay.
2. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. 16K of memory.
And oh, wow. Drive. Massive.
That's what it had. Yeah. And so, you know, you start playing with BASIC and you're like, but there's only certain things you can do with BASIC. You're kind of crammed in BASIC in those days. And you only have 16 or 64K of memory. And right. So, you know, you really have to be very careful about how you read things off tape, because it's tape drive. I mean, it's literally a cassette.
Right.
And so you're like, everything is really slow. So if you want to make a game run faster or whatever, you have to get more of it in memory. Well, the only way to get to write things and get more of it in memory is to learn assembler and mm-hmm. to build, you know, little assembly routines that the BASIC could then call, and then you would get into doing that. And then, you know, my C programming started out the same way. I was doing XBase stuff. I don't know if you know what XBase is, but DBase had its own programming language beyond SQL. And so you could write applications fully in DBase. And there was another one called FoxBase, and it had the same language. So they just ended up calling it XBase. Mm. But again, you were very limited in the amount of things you could do. So what you could do is you could call little Pascal routines or Sue routines or whatever you wanted to from XBase as an external. And so I would actually write little C programs that would like do certain things on the database, open the file, do a certain thing, do some calculations, spit the answer back at DBase or at FoxBase, depending on what I was working on. And that's how I learned C. That's how I started C. And then I was like, this is kind of a cool language. I think I'm just going to go write stuff. So I started writing stuff in C at that
yeah,
point, mostly like on Windows.
C, not even like C++ or C#. And
no,
it was just
this
like,
is before all that. Yeah,
yeah.
This is like, this is way before C++. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, this is Kerrigan Ritchie days. I mean, I picked up the C Primer Plus from Sam's and then the Kerrigan and Ritchie book. And that was the only two books available at the time on learning C.
Hmm.
And so I picked up the Borland compiler. Borland the C compiler, and it had the Pascal compiler. So of course I did stuff in Pascal just to be like, cause it was there. Why not? Right. You know, go learn a little bit of it. And so, yeah, so I started working with the Borland C compiler on writing Windows programs. And believe it or not, the very first program I started working on was, at the time I was just starting out doing competitive shooting, and I didn't have a good way, cause there's this thing called Hatcher's Notebook. It has a set of tables in the back.
Yeah.
That if you take a bullet and you measure a projectile and you measure the velocity at certain distances in its path, you can figure out what's called the ballistic coefficient. And using the ballistic coefficient, you could then figure out what its path would be. But there was no software that would do that at the time when I first started. So when I was doing competitive shooting, I was like,
so were people like using hand calculation? Like,
yes.
Or,
oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Everybody had Hatcher's notebook on the range.
Yeah.
And they would like pop open to the back and look at the table and
right.
sit down and figure it out. So, you know, it wasn't portable or anything. It was running on a Windows machine, but I figured out how to write a program that just took the Hatcher's notebook tables
yeah.
and convert. Cause most of the bullet manufacturers or manufacturers give you the ballistic coefficient. They calculate it.
At yeah.
They know what it is. So you can just take the ballistic coefficient and write a piece of software. And there's all sorts of commercial stuff that does that today. But this is way before all that commercial stuff was available. And so it was like something to do that helped me pick out some C programming skills and also helped me with a little bit of my longer range. I stopped doing long range competitive shooting when I left the Air Force and started doing short range stuff, and I never gone back to long range stuff, but you know, we were shooting 1,000 yard stuff, and you can't shoot 1,000 yard stuff without understanding hold over, hold under,
right?
And, you know, what the wind is going to do on the projectile, stuff like that. So I there was nothing doing any of that. So I just had, like, there were tables and that was it.
Did that ever get you anything? Like, because I've had guests before where they start making games and, you know, that actually got them into, given the first win, right? And then that propels them into, so did that, you know, like your program actually get you a first internship or anything like that?
No, just a half a dozen people picked it up and started using it. And eventually I stopped maintaining it and it went away. It just never really did anything. Because I went into networking instead.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
So, I mean, instead of doing programming, I thought, you know, this is all kind of cool, but networking is actually closer to my electronics career, like closer to my electronics world. And because it's all about modulation and stuff like that. And of course, you know, I was working on radio, so modulation. And when I was in the Air Force, I was working on airfield electronics. So I was working on VORs and TACNs, and it's all about modulation and fields and all that other stuff, and difference of depth of modulation. And we use log periodic dipoles for the ILS system on the localizer. And then we had some Yagis that we used. So, I mean, it was all very familiar territory for me working on electronics in the Air Force. And then, you know, when I got into computers, it was like the modulation side is what piqued my interest more and the side of transmission and building the network more than coding. Coding seemed interesting, but like, I don't know.
It's too abstracted.
It's more abstracted than what it was working on the network. So I got involved in the networking side. And really that happened because I knew enough about computers that they drug me into the Air Force at the time didn't have a career field for computers at all. Well, they did. It was for mainframes. And there was another one for crypto. So I
did you say crypto?
Yes.
And okay. Cryptography,
Crypto gear, hardware. Okay. Hardware and software for crypto, Stu 3s and KG84s and stuff like that.
Yeah, not like Bitcoins or anything like that.
No.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the same principles, right?
Sure.
It's the same stuff. But I mean, this isn't SHA-3. You know, this isn't SHA-256 or anything. This is before, again, all of that stuff. This is when you got a Stu 3, and the Stu 3 had built-in encryption, and it had tapes, paper tapes to set the keys. Like as a one-time pad, and that's what you had, like in KG84s and stuff like that, all had one-time pads. And you know, you had a rip-off pad, literally a pad, or on one of them we had a little box that would print out a paper tape, and that paper tape had your key on it for this period of time,
right?
And it would spit out the paper, a new paper tape, and it wasn't necessarily half an hour or a day. It was kind of randomized. Like there was an algorithm that was making them all spit out the same key at the same time. And that's how you did your key sharing for secret key. So that's kind of like, so anyway, I kind of worked on that stuff a little bit, but I really got drug into, because there was no career field for computers. I got drug into the computer side because I knew how to build a computer and I knew how to do a bit of hacking.
Yeah.
And so they were like, okay, you can do this. And then this project came along that was like, we need to build a new network for the entirety of McGuire Air Force Base.
And
for the Air Force.
Yeah.
We need a new network. And so Scott Air Force Base was using Novell NetWare.
Yeah.
So I went off and did a lot of research into Novell NetWare, and I was working with an outside contractor who was working with Cabletron gear and building the physical, like laying the fiber across the base. And then I got involved in the telco side because we had a very old Stroger switch, 10,000 line mainframe sitting in one of the buildings. And then we had a bunch of media, a bunch of building distribution frames that were crossbar fabrics out the 21st Air Force and stuff like that. So I got sucked into that, and I got sucked into crypto through doing that, doing some of the crypto gear because of that. And there were other things, but I basically became more doing like telco type stuff and more communications type stuff than working on the airfield. And I think one of the reasons I left the Air Force was because they said, all right, we've created a new career field for this. You can either switch to that career field and go back through tech training.
Yeah.
Or you know, you can go back to the shop and work on the airfield. And I was like, well, I really don't want to work on the airfield anymore. You know, it's kind of like the computer stuff is a lot cooler. So
yeah.
I left the Air Force and got a job at a small value-added reseller just doing computer networks, doing Novell NetWare and Banyan Vines mostly.
Yeah. But I mean, that was what year was that? Because I know subsequently you had a very much a, you know, luminary career at Cisco, at you were, you know, testifying before Congress to explain how internet works and it all of these other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so I was there until 93.
Yeah.
And then I left the Air Force. I went into this thing doing Banyan Vines and stuff. And then I just decided to move to North Carolina. Crazy. Okay. I was in New Jersey and I was like, enough. I want to move to North Carolina. So I moved to North Carolina and the first job I got was at Cisco.
Okay.
And I was working in, I was a grade 3, which is like ridiculously low grade level at Cisco.
Okay.
And I was working in the hardware team.
Okay.
Taking cases in TAC, just,
okay,
you know, doing RMEs and stuff.
Right.
And then they moved me to Fast Track Engineering, and I was working on frame relay mostly. Mm-hmm. 99% of the time was frame relay.
Right.
And some basic IP stuff. And then I did... you know, it was time to move on from there. And it was kind of like, do I want to go into desktop because I already know IPX? Or do I want to go into the IP routing backline, TRT?
Yeah.
So Alvaro and James Ng and Don Slice convinced me to do the IP routing TRT. And it was not an area I was extremely familiar with, but they were like, you can learn it. Let's do it. Like, why do you want to keep doing IPX? Like, IP is the future. Come over here and work with us on IP. So I jumped into the IP routing TRT. Backline TRT and was taking cases on OSPF, ISIS, all of that stuff. EIGRP was, of course, my initial specialty.
Oh, really? Okay. Tech. I didn't know that. I think first encountered your work with the Cisco press book, right? Was it Cisco Express Pro Forwarding or?
It could be any. I mean, Cisco Express Forwarding, yeah. So I did a lot of, because in those days we had access to the source code.
Yeah.
To iOS, all of it, like all of it. And the 7200 and parts of the 25 and 26 were developed in Raleigh, So I knew the people firsthand who were working on like parts of the 7500 and the 7200, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I got into router architecture and trying to figure out like, how does all this stuff actually work?
Right.
Part of that was also because I was one of the first support techs on the Cisco PICS. When Cisco bought the PICS, they gave us access to the source code for the PICS.
PICS being the firewall, right? Because yeah, I think the very, they rebranded yeah, right. it and called yeah, it something yeah, else, yeah, like yeah. Firepower.
It was originally just the PICS. And it was a little 2RU or 4RU white box that had just basically an Intel processor in it.
That's all it was. I remember it was like that. It was an acquisition, wasn't it?
And, yeah, it was an acquisition.
Like Finesse, or it was the original... OS and
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the CLI was totally different. But anyways, I'm interested in hearing more about your experience with the 72, 75 and PICS.
Yeah. So I went through that and I started learning a little bit about the architecture and how it worked. And I started going to some of the developer training.
Yeah.
Because for a time they were trying to pull me into the developer side of Cisco instead of the escalation side of Cisco.
Right.
And so, because we were struggling to find EIGRP coders, honestly, EIGRP was like, it was very hard to find somebody who knew it well enough to code it.
Yeah.
And so along the way, I gained commit privileges. So I was committing code part-time and I was doing code reviews and basically all the protocols, all the routing protocols, and got into learning a little bit about the architecture. And then Rodney Dunn and I sat down and said, you know, all these show commands on like, crashes and stuff like that. We spent all this time learning how to train. And that's part of the reason you have to know the architecture of Cisco iOS at those days was to chase down crashes. You had to be able to debug the symbol, you know, find the original source code, look at the code and, you know, file a defect. And it had to be the best defect it could be. So often I was filing defects with the fixes in the defect.
Oh, wow. Like, love you there. Is that just during the core dumps?
At that time, I guess. Yeah. You know, you pull a core dump and you're like, oh, yeah, I can see we're walking past the end of the array.
Exactly. Here's the memory location you should fix.
That's right. Exactly. So, I mean, it was a small company at that time and everybody was doing everything. And so you kind of had to, right? You were on the hook. I was on global escalation. I was on the hook. I had to do everything. So we were doing all this, and Rodney and I were like, well, you know, nobody really understands this stuff. We ought to do a session at Cisco Live on this.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing an 8-hour session on iOS architecture.
Yeah.
And like how to trace down crashes and hangs and, you know, how the scheduler actually works and what all those weird messages like scheduler thrashing and process so-and-so and stuff like that, all that meant. And then we were like, well, that's interesting, but then there's all these weird counters on the interface nobody knows either. So we went over to the 7200 guys and pulled all the original source code for like the 2500 Ethernet driver, which was the simplest driver in Cisco at the time, and started digging around trying to find out what all those mean and then pulling them back because we didn't understand what the chip was doing. We would have to go ask the person who was programming it to say, okay, when you say you have this, what exactly is going on in the chip when that happens?
Like, that's super deep.
What's the PHY doing at this point, right?
Yeah.
Or what's the ASIC doing at this point that it's causing this problem? And so, yeah, so we dug around all that, did that 8-hour session, and then we were like, you know what, this would be a good book. So I got together with Curtis Murphy and Vijay Balaprograda and wrote like Inside Cisco iOS Software Architecture. And
so
and then that led to a second book called Cisco Express Forwarding. Part of it was to just being there when all was invented. Like I was there interacting with Bobby Seal when he was writing the original Ceph code. And the other guy, what was his name? I don't remember now, but anyway, out in London. And then I was there when we were building Graceful Restart, like in the FIB. Like, what does Graceful Restart look like in the FIB? Well, I was there when it was happening. I was helping, interacting with the people writing that code. And so that's a lot of my understanding of that stuff comes from just being like there and just interacting with those people and trying to figure it out. That's kind of how I got into routing is it was electronics through telco crypto type stuff because that was what was needed. And then basic computer stuff and then, you know, just basic computer support. And then it kind of fell into networking over time. And then I went to work for Cisco and it became all networking all the time, basically.
I read those books, but they were so over my head. It was amazing. I have to like really like just clamp down and say drink like 10 cups of coffee and try to digest it. But
crazy.
it was still over my head. It wasn't until much later, I would say like 10-15 years later, when I was really dealing with, you know, some of these other stuff where I have to dig deeper. But like when you're going through, I don't know, your CCNP certification, right? Like it doesn't really help with like on the command line, but it's nonetheless very valuable sources. Yeah. And I would have to say your O'Reilly courses, which I'll provide like links on how, how the internet works, but how the router works. It really was helpful in just putting the pieces into like the right category. And, and then that reminded me of your previous work, which was, I don't know, 15, at least 20 years ago, right? Those books that came out that of those. And like I said, like none of these really click until much later. But I really appreciate, like, I think that was the only, maybe still is the only book out there that exposes the internal workings of like how these things work, right? And like you said, at the time, Cisco made everything. Everything was by Cisco, the chip and all that. It's not like right now, you know, a lot of people have Broadcoms and, you know, Barefoot or whatever.
Yeah, and a lot of the principles are the same.
Yeah.
And honestly, you know, I have to say that a lot of what happened to me is because I grew up in electronics, I learned the importance of theory. I mean, amateur radio test is all theory. Like there's very little memorization on the amateur radio test. I mean, there were like frequency ranges. Okay. If you're in the 40 meter range, what is your actual frequencies top and bottom and this, that, and the other? And, you know, if you're using X amount of power and you're in the 40 and you're at this particular frequency, what are the side bands and what are those powers? Those types of things. But for the most part, when I was learning this stuff, it was all about theory. Mm. Like how does an inverted V work with a horizontally or vertically oriented antenna, right? What's an LPD actually doing? What's a log periodic dipole actually do? What's a Yagi do? Like, how does that actually shape the signal? And like looking at diagrams of what the signal looked like in the air when you were using different kinds of antennas and when you did different things, and how does tropospheric scatter work and all that kind of stuff. And so it was all theory. So I became very theory oriented much younger. And I think a lot of networking people really struggle to become theory oriented. They're much more command line oriented.
Yeah, very tactical.
Thankfully for me, I didn't start out that way. I mean, everything was theory for me from day one. And so it's just always been for me like, okay, that's great. The command line's great on this 2500, but I want to actually know what that means.
Right.
When I look at that, I want to know, like, if it says an overrun, what's an overrun? Like, what does that actually mean? Mm. What's going on in the chip that causes it to spit an error that says overrun?
Right.
What is that?
Right. You're not happy with the wall garden. You wanted break it out and say, how was this made?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's exactly right. And so I think that's been something that happened to me when I was very young.
Yeah.
And I can just thank my whole engineering family for it. Everybody in my family is either engineering or farming. And that's it. Like, that's all there is.
You made it sound like they're very related, right? to most common folks like me, it's like engineering and farming.
Yeah, I know. No, but I mean, my grandfather was a county agent. And so his whole job was not farming per se, although he had a farm. Let's be honest, he owned 7 ponies and a couple of horses and I don't know, whatever else. But, so 7, whatever ponies it was anyway. And, you know, but he had a few acres that he plowed down, but he wasn't a farmer. That's not what he did.
Right.
He farmed to learn how to farm. That's the only reason he farmed. It was like, okay, a new variety of corn has come out. I'm going to try it with this and that and the other in my field. And then when I go to talk to some farmer that I'm helping to build a new farm or to helping there, I'm going to be able to explain to them why they should use. That was his whole mindset. Like, you know, why should you blast a new pond? Because it's going to give you fish and it's going to allow you to do agriculture. It's going to allow you to give water to your cows and your horses and your livestock. And it's going to, you know, and he had all these things. And by the way, he was horrible to fish with. You never wanted to go fishing with him.
But farming and corn, that's his gig.
Yeah. Well, no, because he knew the bottom layout of every pond and every lake in the entire area.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. House.
So he would like throw his lure in and he would be like 15 minutes later, it'd be like, there's my limit. What have you been doing? And you're like, what? I haven't caught anything.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
like, well, it's you just got to know where the fish live. Huh?
I just finished reading Amazon Unbound, and that actually reminded me what you were talking about, your experience on the farm and grandpa really reminded me of how Bezos recalled that, like, his childhood spending with his grandfather that inspired his like passion for space, for Blue Origin and all the other stuff. But that's, you know, just listening to you, that makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, they are related, right? In the context that you brought it in.
Yeah. It's asking why rather than just what constantly. It's the constantly not being happy with. He was never happy with, okay, that corn grew better than that corn.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Like,
okay,
so
that's
be
an
it.
Observational fact, right? But that doesn't do me any good if I'm trying to help farmers.
Right. Right.
Increase their cash. Like, that doesn't help me. I need to know why, because I need to be able to walk over to their farm, look at their soil and say, no, your soil is a little bit different than mine.
Right. Right? And how is it different?
Exactly.
Why is it different?
That was his mindset. That was constantly his mindset. And so I think it just comes from my entire childhood being constantly pushed. Like, even in the Boy Scouts, it was never tie this knot. It was always, why would you use this knot? Why is this knot good for that?
Right. Right.
And what other situations might you use this knot in?
Yeah. Comes in handy when you're like hanging by the thread, trying on the cliff of a tree or whatever.
So, yeah. So that's kind of like, I don't know. It's always been asking why. And I think that's what really brought me along, is just asking why constantly.
That's amazing. And I think it's the thread, the same thread throughout your career. And but I wanted to talk a little bit about what was after Cisco, though, because there's that long, like, still very much a lot of projects after Cisco that you did. I don't want to make it sound like, you know,
I was a Cisco for 16 years. I joined as a, you know, as a
tech
engineer, and I left as a distinguished architect.
Yeah.
in kind of on the marketing side of things a little bit. And
oh, really?
Doing,
okay.
Yeah, it was an architecture team on the sales side, basically. Mm-hmm. And so then I went to, I guess after that, VeriSign.
Mm-hmm. And VeriSign, I remember that.
Yeah, VeriSign, I was mostly working on BGP security and DNS and DFZ stuff and trying to understand how to, like, this is back in the day when DNS wasn't scaled the way it is today.
Okay.
So how do you build a fabric? How do you build data centers? I mean, we just called them data centers at that time, right?
Sure.
We didn't have a formal thing around fabrics that, you know, will get you to where you need to be to scale DNS and other things, because we were trying to sell other services beyond DNS at that point.
Yeah.
And then how do BGP things interact with DNS things? I mean, just as a, for instance, if I see a new BGP advertisement and it's kind of weird, what characteristics about that BGP advertisement might indicate to me that I have a spam or an attack coming because of this new BGP advertisement, right? Can I actually pin that down and try to understand that as a research project? Like, is there a way to do something about that to make that actionable data? Now, nothing ever happened with that stuff, but that's what I was working on. Mm. And then after VeriSign, I went to work for VCE for like 6 months, not even.
Okay.
It just wasn't my place to be. Mm. And then I went to work for, I guess it was Ericsson at that time.
Okay.
And Ericsson was interesting because I was taking some of my telco background and reapplying it, because that was about the time that AT&T, for instance, was replacing their COs with data center fabrics.
Mm. Okay.
And that's really where I started to learn data center fabrics at a bigger scale and understanding it. Mm-hmm. And then I went out and worked with Telepost Greenland and all sorts of other places when I was at Ericsson. And then Ericsson kind of, they partnered with Cisco and kind of killed Redback.
Okay. Yeah, Redback, I remember that.
Redback was the part of Ericsson I was working for.
I see.
It was really Redback, and or the old Redback as it was. And kind of Redback kind of collapsed, and they kind of just let a lot of people go.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over and worked for LinkedIn.
Mm.
And then after LinkedIn for a couple of years, Microsoft bought LinkedIn, and I went to Juniper and worked there. And then I left Juniper and went to Akamai.
Yep.
And part of that is just like, I've been a vendor for a long time, 16 mm-hmm. years at Cisco, a couple of 3 years at Ericsson, a couple of 3 years at Juniper.
Right.
Like, I feel like I need to be at operators more sometimes.
And you pick the biggest of them all.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
that's how you roll, man. That's just how it is.
I mean, that wasn't really intentional. That was more, I know people and they were like, we're looking for an architect and hey, you know, let's have a discussion. And, you know, it just turned out to be a good place to go. I was talking to other places at the same time.
Sure.
But yeah. And I'm kind of, I don't really want to work for Google or Facebook or any of those. I mean, I've had offers from Facebook and Google and
it's not,
it's not like I'm really opposed like to there's some other reason. I just am not all that interested. I'm more interested in things like Akamai or, you know, something like that than just that environment or whatever.
And for people who doesn't know, like, I mean, so for me, Akamai was still very much like a CDN provider, but mm-hmm. I don't know if they start branching out into like Cloudflare, right? They started with CDN and then now getting into like DDoS mitigation and, you know, building their own backbones and so on. So what is your day-to-day like at Akamai, or like what is your main focus with an operator versus like a vendor nowadays? Yeah.
So my actual position is I work for Prolexic, which is the DDoS mitigation arm.
Yep. Yep.
So day-to-day I'm mostly focused on how to make Prolexic scale better and more future stuff. I'm much more future oriented. I'm on a team of architects. Many of the architects on my team are not so future oriented as I am, which is cool. I mean, you know, you've got to have a variety. You got to have people who are looking at the here and now and understanding things, and people who are looking at the future more.
Right.
And so, you know, my focus is primarily on integration with the rest of the company. Every piece of Akamai tends to operate as a separate thing. And so I'm deeply involved in the FR deployment, FR routing deployments throughout Akamai, not just because the node uses FR routing. And we use FR routing at the edge for various other reasons. And, you know, FR routing is deployed in other fabrics and stuff like that. So I tend to cross all the boundaries when it comes to working with FR routing and even with fabric design and with BGP stuff and whatever. I mean, there's just stuff that goes on all the time.
Yeah.
And so I get sucked into all of it, which is fine with me. If it's routing oriented, that's fine. So my primary focus is Prolexic, but I tend to do a lot, even with DNS and even with other pieces of the company. So I tend to interact a lot with the rest of the company. So my day-to-day is largely meetings around something to do with performance or, you know, something like that. Things that are going on that need to be looked at. And then future-facing stuff.
Yeah. Right?
Like, how should we shift our architecture to allow us to deploy 5 new things, sellable products in 5 years? And those are not just product questions. Those are architecture questions about how do you build a network that's flexible enough to support all these new products that's not so overly complex that right. your knock is falling off the side of the earth going, no, stop, no, you know, kind of
yeah. thing. And that's super important, right? Because I think people, I've read stories about, you know, the projection on, you know, if you start in LA and you're trying to fly to New York, if you just shift it, you know, 5 degrees, you're never going to end up in New York. You're going to be in Canada somewhere, mm-hmm. right? So I think what you're doing is worth its weight in gold, where you've set the right direction so you eventually get to where you want to go without too much, you know, very little margin of error.
Yeah, that's kind of what we try to do. That's kind of what the goal is of the team, or that's pretty much what it is. And again, we have people who are more short term, which is cool, which is good. We need those people. We have people who are more project management on the team, et cetera, et cetera. That's all great because we need all those people, you know, and I just tend to be more of the longer term. You know, think about what we're doing in 5 years.
Yeah. Like,
think about how we build stuff to make it different 5 years from now or whatever. Just tends to be my thing. And that tends to be where and also interacting with lots of other areas of the company. Like I said, DNS team, and we have 2 different DNS teams, and then we have a core networking team, and we have all sorts of other teams. And so, yeah, I try to interact as much as I can with those people and
nice.
And pull things together. So,
yeah, that explains a lot. And that's why, you know, I really enjoyed the various aspects on your podcast, where that explains why there's, you know, like DDoS talks, right? Like, and those are excellent. I listen to all of them, and the network automation, you mentioned BGP and all of that. So, yeah. So, I mean, speaking of which, I mean, this is probably a good time to wrap up the first part of our conversation. Okay. And where can people find you on social, on blogs? And obviously we're going to have it in the show notes, but where can people yeah. follow your work?
So the best place to follow me is rule11.tech. And not yep. because I do tons there, but because I try to cross post everything there. Like I write for Packet Pushers and Mind Matters yes. and other places, but I try to like cross post everything on Rule 11.
Okay.
Just so that it's a single place to follow my work, basically. And all the Hedge episodes are there and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I follow Russ's work there. That's for sure. All right. Cool. I'm going to wrap up the part one, but stay tuned for part two, where we dive more into, you know, Russ's recommendation for people in various stages of their careers. So, thanks for being here with me, and I look forward to part two. Thank you for listening to Network Automation Nerds podcast today. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other major podcast platforms. Until next time. Bye-bye.